Christopher Marston is the CEO of Exemplar Law Partners, LLC, in Boston, Massachusetts. He's been receiving a lot of press coverage lately. Why? Chris, a member of the Massachusetts Bar, was the CFO of a technology company. This is his first venture into the legal profession. He brings his financial and management expertise to the opening of Exemplar Partners. Chris talks about providing value to clients. This means, among other things, no hourly billing and valuing the firm's human capital by creating the right work environment. He also talks about getting clients more involved with their own legal matter to help increase their level of satisfaction. Listen to Chris's comments, which are unbiased by historical restraints of the legal profession, and if you agree with him, think about how you can apply his principles to your own law firm and practice.
Chris, thanks for joining us today on Law Biz Management's podcast. I look forward to our chat.
I do as well. Thank you.
You have been in the press quite a bit lately in your law firm as something special and different. And before we get to exactly what makes you different, tell me and our listeners, where did you practice law before you started your own business here?
Well, actually, this was the first primary experience in the legal industry. My role as chief executive of this firm is as much in the business side as it is in the law side. So pretty much right out of a law and business school, after somewhat of a career in business, I founded Exemplar Law Partners.
So, in other words, you come to the law from the business world. What kind of business were you in before?
I was a chief financial officer of JSA Technologies, a technology company that has since moved to Texas from the Boston area and still around today. My business background is in finance and management.
So, in other words, you come to the practice of law with sort of a slightly different perspective than most of us coming out of law school and having really an experience only in the law as a business, if you will, but really from the service side rather than from the business side as you've done.
Yeah, that's correct. I have a couple business degrees, both in finance, and my business experience provided some great insights and a great sort of fresh perspective on our industry when I entered it that has really allowed me to, create efficiencies that a lot of others don't see naturally.
Well, I think if I were to play devil's advocate a little bit here, if I were in your position with the background that you have, it would be a natural to become part of a mid-size or even larger law firm offering something special with your technology background and your business background. What motivated you to start your own practice?
Ed, that's a wonderful question. It's ripe for a great answer as well. Coming back on that, you would think it'd be quite logical that somebody with my background or somebody with a lot more to offer would be valued in a mid or large firm. But the reality is that they don't value the extra education. They actually see it as a threat. Interestingly enough, it all boils down to the billable hour model, because large firms are operating under an economic model that doesn't add value to their environment or their bottom line, really, to have the added experience. To give you an example, people coming out of school are used by the big firms as leverage to increase their bottom line. So generally, you don't have any client contact. You're really there to eat the food that's on the plate in front of you, and therefore any of my business experience or background would never inure to the benefit of the client. And of course, your billable rate is your rate, regardless of how many degrees you have. That is a function of how many years in practice. If there's no limit to how long I can answer the question, I would tell you that it's also an industry where there's a lot of pride and ego, and corporate attorneys have been serving business clients for decades. Despite the numerous articles written over the years about how in-house counsel is wanting their attorneys to be more strategic and more business-minded, obviously the attorneys insist that they're providing excellent service regardless of what the clients say. And the impact of that is to go to a firm and interview with a partner and try and convince them to value your business experience. is really subconsciously trying to convince them that they're lacking something. And you're simply not going to be able to do that.
Well, I understand that. I recently issued a special report that is entitled Business Competency for Lawyers. My initial working title was Business Literacy for Lawyers. And I realized soon after I saw that on the page that that suggests that our lawyer brethren don't have a certain skill that they need. So we changed it from literacy to competency. But I'm surprised to hear that you're talking about folks not valuing what you bring to the table, that they saw that as a threat. How did that get manifested? How was it that you were able to perceive that they were threatened?
Well, I mean, when you interview with these firms, you understand the attitudes that are prevalent in the firms. But also, I have interviewed and had the privilege of interviewing at least a couple hundred attorneys, more than 300 by phone, but more than 150 in person from across the nation. And what I can tell you from firsthand experience is that attorneys with multiple skill sets and degrees are feeling like there is not a place for them in our industry. They leave the legal industry, or they go in-house, or they go start businesses because they feel like the traditional model does not value or accommodate that skill set. And the reality is that we all want to find a workplace that values who we are and puts our skills to use. And unfortunately, the one-size-fits-all systems that exist today are pervasive across our industry, that just doesn't work for the multiple skill set attorney.
When you started your own practice then, how did you deal with the business side of the new practice?
Since I have a business and finance background, I actually had spent 6 months of doing full-time research and business planning and then prepared a thorough business plan for where we're headed. And knowing that that's exactly how a well-planned startup company would do it. Because if you don't know where you're going, you don't know how you're going to get there, the best way to get there. So that's what I did to proceed, because I understood that it's not enough in today's competitive world just to solve one or two problems here and there and think that you're going to last in the marketplace. You've got to altogether create something that's better all around, and it requires a lot of planning and a lot of thinking.
What kinds of things did you do when you set up this business plan? If you can take us through the steps one by one.
In terms of creating a business plan?
Right.
Okay. Well, I mean, the first step was to identify what are the problems. I think those are the easiest things. You can go out and find market research on attrition rates being at all-time highs, professional satisfaction at historic lows, mentoring at all-time lows, billable hour requirements at all-time highs, lack of cultural diversity and lack of gender diversity, and work-life balance concerns, all on the tops of the minds of the legal professionals entering the profession today. And that gives you a lot of guidance in how to proceed. Now, you have to figure out what is the root of the problem, because you can't solve it if you don't know what's causing it. That had led me to was to discover that our business model, under which the whole industry operates in corporate law, is causing pretty much all of these problems. And from there, you have to solve it. Now, because nobody's going to be impressed if you think the welfare system is terrible. People want solutions. And I think that's one of the biggest complaints clients have about law firms also, is that they're deal breakers and not deal makers, because lawyers are trained to identify problems and not solve them. I could explain that if I had to. Going and finding a better way requires some research and what are best practices that are out there, what industries have models that do work, what are they doing, and also creative out-of-the-box thinking. What can be done? How should we do it? And forgetting about what has been done, because, I mean, frankly, it's quite impressive that lawyers who are trained to question everything on behalf of their clients have operated their practices for decades, not even having asked themselves why they bill by the hour. Because it was an accident in the history of the law, in fact, a recent accident.
Well, one of the things you clearly set forth is the identification of the problems. How did you go about finding solutions? One of the things you said was to look at other industries and see how they have addressed some of these same issues. What industries, for example, did you look at that mirror these problems but found better solutions than we have thus far?
There wasn't a particular industry, and it depended on what the problem was. Let's say take the heart of the model, that being the value pricing model. The best place to look for that is in addressing lawyers' concerns directly that law services are too amorphous or too uncertain in order to value price, which you know, is easily refuted. You just look to the high-end consulting firms like McKinsey and other companies, Accenture, that operate under these models, and they're selling high-end, amorphous, hard-to-quantify services that are to their clients on a fixed-price basis and are tremendously profitable. And if they can do it, we can do it, and it's a matter of you've got to understand your business. We had to be creative and say, well, how do you do it? Well, you do it by having a lot more thought in the front end before you go ahead and do a job. It's quite easy to be lazy when you bill by the hour. You don't have to sit down and understand the scope of a problem, and perhaps that's why clients experience so much frustration. Lawyers couldn't possibly communicate the scope of the work if they aren't in any way in their practice required to sit down and understand it themselves. After all, they just have to fill out a timesheet as they go along. For other things, like valuing human capital, that you can look to any industry. We looked at Starbucks and the role of pouring your heart and passion into your business and how important it is to create a work environment where our people really find meaning in the workplace and the relationships they have and how and the mentoring they get and the training. And, you know, Starbucks is a great model. Starbucks is also a fantastic model of taking, and so is Poland Springs and Avion Water, of taking what was a low-end commoditized market and turning it into a very high-end market that created a customer experience. And water, for instance, is the most abundant resource on Earth, and if they can differentiate that and sell it more per barrel than oil, then we can differentiate law services through great service and a customer experience.
Well, you talked a couple of, or you've mentioned a couple of times the word corporate, and I'm thinking from your commentary that your practice is primarily, if not exclusively, transactional with corporate America. Am I correct in that? Do you do any litigation, for example?
Yes, we're doing corporate, full-service corporate services as well as litigation.
And how do you price out the litigation work? Is it likewise based on a value, non-hourly modality?
That is correct. We absolutely will not bill by the hour, and we have not had a single customer ask us to.
Walk us through, if you will, some of the thinking that goes about when you sit down to determine a fixed price for a litigation matter. Obviously, many lawyers say, well, we don't know what we're getting into. We don't know you know, how many depositions the other side's going to throw at us, and on and on and on. We just don't know, and therefore we have to bill by the hour.
Right.
How do you deal with this analysis?
Well, it's the easiest thing to do is to throw your hands up in the air and say, I simply don't know. Now, the most important information they're leaving out is that there's a lot more they can know if they actually took the time to know. But you'd have to take the time and not fill out your timesheet and try and bill a client just because you've got to understand what on earth it is you're getting into. And that's a different mindset. It really does require an entirely different attitude and way of approaching the business. The biggest misconception about pricing, fixed pricing a litigation matter is that there's some relationship between the time it takes and the price. And all of this goes into pricing theory, which is the root of it, is that there is no relationship between time and value. Oftentimes there's an inverse relationship. So everybody asks me, how do you know how long it's going to take? And to which I, of course, respond, it doesn't matter how long it takes. You just have to know, you don't have to know everything that might happen. In a fixed price engagement, you just have to put a little boundary around what you know is certain to happen or likely to happen, and then you put a price on that. So, for instance, if you're taking a look at a litigation matter, you can say, well, certain things are bound to happen. You can fix price at discovery stage, and of course you don't know how many depositions will be involved and how much paper will be involved. But at the same time, you do know there are certain motions that could be filed over the course of pretrial litigation, and that if you actually did your homework, you actually could give the client some idea of the percentage of success on the affirmative motions that you can file, and some opinion of the strength of the opponent's motions that they could file, and help them to make a cost-benefit analysis and determine whether it's worth their money to spend a lot of money or time responding to those motions. If you know that certain motions are going to occur, or that a certain minimum amount of discovery will occur, you can put a boundary around that and put a price on it.
So in other words, in effect, you're creating a budget for this particular litigation that has to be approved by the client. Am I correct?
That's correct. We involve the client in every decision, and instead of leaving them in the dark, we really give them a roadmap and then help them to make strategic decisions that's based on a cost-benefit analysis. Because what I found, and perhaps it's my business background and from talking to other executives, is that there's a great gap in the decision-making process between attorneys and lawyers. You see, lawyers are trained to reduce risk at all cost, and that's simply not how businesses operate. Obviously, we have venture capital funds, and why, if you ask them about risk, they would say, we don't care about risk. We just care about the relationship between risk and our return on investment. And that's what the business people want. They want to be able to understand risk in terms of how much payoff they're going to get for taking that risk. And if you help them to make those decisions, then in the course of a litigation, for instance, they can choose to be strategic and save money by putting more time and money into the winning motions and less into the ones that don't have a shot.
I would imagine, based on my own experience, that preparing the budget, as you're suggesting, is quite time-consuming, very involved. You almost have to get into the case itself and really understand what is happening, what's likely to happen, and so forth. Who pays for this, and how do you charge for this kind of analysis before you actually get going?
That all depends on how complex the analysis is. If it's a large case, the client could very well pay for it. Because value pricing, even for the pricing in the staging process, it is almost more of a business planning process. It's kind of business and law hand in hand. The fact is that businesses do value information. They always have, and they've proven to be able to to spend money on getting valuable information that helps them run their businesses better. So what I have found is that customers are willing to pay to receive a certain amount of information that helps them make good decisions.
Well, Chris, tell us a little bit about your firm, when you started, how large you are today, and what you see for the firm's future.
Sure. About a year and a half ago, probably a year and 9 months now, is when the business plan and research was started. Our first round of interviews, and as soon as I completed the business plan, we put ads out nationally because we have a different philosophy. Leaders don't just happen to have bar admission in one state. Leaders can be anywhere in the country. And what we are looking for is to create a world-class organization from the ground up consisting of top leaders in this nation who get it. So in November of 2004, is when we started interviewing from across the country have since received even more than 600. It's probably close to 700 applicants by now, and interviewed, at least by phone, more than 300 and over 150 in person. That being the case, we didn't rush to market. We actually carefully selected our team members and didn't even open for business until about 5 months ago. And since then, there's been a tremendous response a lot of support from within the industry, and I know that what we're doing here is we're changing people's lives, and that's really exciting. There are 9 of us right now, not including any support staff we have, and we're growing at a rate of about 1 a month. The goal of our organization is to be a national and international firm, and provide the type of service and products and services in the marketplace that simply don't exist today.
Well, you certainly have gotten a tremendous amount of publicity, tremendous PR along the way, and it's indicative of the attitude that you bring to the table, as evidenced by this interview, and my hat is off to you. If you were to have your magic cape around you, as Johnny Carson might say some years ago, and you look into the crystal ball, what do you see as the future of your firm, and what do you see as the future of our profession?
That's a wonderful question, Ed, and I hope I can take a couple minutes to answer it. As far as the future of our firm, I really do see 5 years down the road Exemplar being in several different markets, perhaps one international market, and at least in three or four other local markets. Probably about, did you say 5 years or 10 years?
No, I just said the future. You picked the time frame.
Excellent. Really over the course of time, having a presence in the growing and emerging markets across the country and across the world, and developing strategic alliances and partnerships that are truly powerful and serve needs across both a business and legal function, because they really do work hand in hand. As far as our profession is concerned, Ed, what we're seeing is some very interesting changes in the legal profession that I would equate to what I'm seeing in the energy industry. What we are is a matured industry. Same with energy, a very staid and stodgy, at least that's how it's perceived, industry. And for the first time ever, what I'm seeing is that the rate of change is increasing, which is indicative of an industry that is reaching a tipping point or a point of crisis. And those types of curves indicate to me that there's going to be a change in our marketplace in the next decade or so, that what the legal industry looks like today is going to be more different 10 years from now than it was, than the difference between 10 years ago and today. And that's the same with energy, as we're seeing renewable energy companies come up and oil prices go up, and concerns and new companies are starting to pop up and solve problems, because the industry has reached a point of crisis that's getting people's attention and getting them to rally behind a cause. And we have a point of crisis, and I believe in our profession, with our human capital, with people endlessly dissatisfied with their professional lives, with where they work, and what it is that they're doing every day, not feeling connected to it. And I do believe that firms that come up and try to be a part of the solution and not part of the problem are really going to shape tomorrow's law firm. And that's going to take so many different forms that I could only imagine, but hats off to all of the leaders who are going to take part in innovating and taking this industry to the next level.
Well, Chris, I want to thank you for joining us today. It is a pleasure to see somebody share some of my concerns expressed over the years and look at the business of law in a different perspective, with out-of-the-box thinking and willingness to try new ventures. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. Appreciate it.
You have been listening to a Law Biz podcast. For more podcasts, please visit www.lawbiz.com/podcasts.html. Feel free to tell your friends and colleagues about Law Biz podcasts. You may duplicate this program in part or in whole, provided that you retain appropriate attribution and copyright notices.